Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio. If you're listening to this broadcast on medium or shortwave in Europe or America, then this announcement is for you. As of July 1st, our programs will no longer be broadcast in these areas and on these frequencies. But they will still be available via satellite, on the internet, on demand and in podcast, and on local radio stations that rebroadcast them. For details, visit our website at vaticanradio.va.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, Pope Benedict comforts victims of devastating earthquakes in northern Italy. The president of Caritas Syria appeals for help to meet the growing humanitarian needs in his country ravaged by violence. And Christian Aid says the Earth Conference Rio Plus 20 lacks urgency and oomph, putting social justice in jeopardy. Pope Benedict flew up to Italy's northern region of Emilia-Romagna Tuesday to express his solidarity and pray with victims of a series of powerful earthquakes that devastated the area last month. At least 12,000 people across a large swathe of north-central Italy saw their homes destroyed or damaged and are living in tents and makeshift camps. Thousands braved the soaring temperatures and scorching sun to greet the Pope when he arrived in San Marino di Carpi outside Modena and hear his words of comfort.
Fin dai primi giorni del terremoto che vi ha colpito, sono stato sempre vicino a voi.
A visibly moved Pope Benedict said he had been following their plight since the first quake struck May 20th and had remained close to them in prayer and concern. But he said when he heard their plight had become even harder, he felt an increasing need to come in person to be with them. In offering prayers for those families and communities who had lost loved ones in the destruction, the Pope said he wanted everyone in every town to feel how the Pope's heart is close to theirs, to console them, but above all to encourage and support them. Pope Benedict recalled flying over the stricken region on his way up to Milan in early June for the World Meeting of Families, saying he had wanted to visit them then, and his thoughts turned frequently to them. He said he knew that besides suffering the material consequences, your souls were also tried by the continued tremors, even strong ones, and by the loss of several symbolic or historic buildings of the towns, amongst which many churches. On his arrival in Rovereto di Novi, near Modena, Pope Benedict toured the Red Zone, the historic and hardest-hit part of town, where parish priest Ivan Martini died in the collapse of his church as he tried to rescue a statue of Our Lady.
Qui a Rovereto di Novi, nel crollo della chiesa che ho appena visto, ha perso la vita Don Ivan Martini, rendendo omaggio alla sua memoria.
Paying tribute to his memory, the Pope commended the local clergy for demonstrating generous love for God's people and pointed to the comfort he found in reading Psalm 46, which recalls the trembling earth. In that passage, the Pope said God is seen as our refuge and our fortress, especially in times of anguish and duress. On this rock, with this firm hope, the Pope said, we can build, we can rebuild. And likening the tragedy to post-war Italy, the Pope reminded the quake victims that they are not alone, and that their country was rebuilt, certainly thanks also to the help received, but above all, thanks to the faith of so many people moved by the spirit of true solidarity. Some 24 people died in the series of quakes, and at least 300 were injured. Besides its historic and artistic treasures dating back centuries, Emilia-Romagna is one of Italy's most productive regions, where luxury cars, Parmesan cheese, machinery, and ceramic products are manufactured. The destruction has hit production hard in an Italian market already reeling from the effects of the global economic crisis. Well, my colleague Linda Bordoni traveled through the earthquake zone just last weekend on her way up north. She sat down with me to share some of the scenes that touched her most.
I was actually traveling through the area. I was on a train on my way to the north, and I traveled through the area where the very epicenter of the earthquake took place. This is over a month ago now. It's a very sad sight. It's a very productive area of Italy. The fields are all being cultivated and work is continuing, but the farmhouses, especially the old farmhouses, are very damaged. A lot of them are crumbled completely to the ground. Others have big fencing with warning not to go close because of danger. And hundreds and hundreds of tents you can see in the parks, blue tents that have been set up. Even though the shocks haven't been strong, people are obviously very afraid to go into their houses. So notwithstanding the heat wave, they are sleeping in plastic tents. And another thing that struck me was all the tents in the gardens. People obviously not wanting to leave their homes, but being too afraid to sleep inside, they have a tent in the garden. So they're close to their belongings, but they obviously feel less in danger. And another thing that's striking is that work continues. The people are in the fields. They are cultivating the wheat. It's crop picking time right now. Just a very, very sad feeling to see all the destruction in such a carefully and beautifully looked after part of the countryside.
Sure, and it's also one of the industrial heartlands of Italy. You have the Parmesan cheese factories, you have the balsamic vinegar, you have ceramic factories and so on, and a lot of those people are really struggling to get back to work. Some of the big warehouses that in which they worked collapsed during the earthquakes.
They too have built structures in which they can continue to produce, because it's really the economic heartland of Italy. It's where it's the motor, can we say.
So, I think I saw on one of the television broadcasts recently that some of the, like you said, some of these industries have moved outdoors.
That's right.
So they're in the open air and doing their work outside, and then in the evening they bring all the equipment back inside.
But do you know that you and I can buy Parmesan cheese that has been damaged by the earthquake at a low price? Going through the Conf Agricoltura, who are the people who produce and distribute this very precious cheese, where you can buy 1 kilo slices because the Parmesan pieces have been destroyed. And so they are asking the population to help by buying this excellent cheese, which isn't in its original shape, but is the cheese, and it's an extra incentive and an extra help to the population.
Mm. So what do you think these people are looking for from Pope Benedict?
Prayers.
And hope that things will get back to normal as soon as possible.
That the earth stops shaking finally and they can get back into their homes.
And thanks there to my colleague, Linda Bordoni. The head of Caritas Syria is appealing for help to meet the growing needs of Syrians in the face of ongoing violence there. Chaldean Bishop Antoine Odo of Aleppo says some of the greatest needs are in the area of health care and education. In this interview with me, Bishop Odo says Caritas Syria is present in the battered city of Homs and the surrounding area, providing food, medicine, and tuition for some 700 families. Caritas Syria is also offering assistance to displaced families who have left Homs, helping them rent apartments elsewhere. Well, last year, he explains, Caritas managed to provide assistance to thousands of people in Syria on a budget of $1 million. But that sum is not enough now for the Catholic Aid Agency to be able to meet the increasing needs of people as the situation deteriorates.
Caritas is present especially now in Homs and around in Damascus, of course, in Aleppo, in what we call Wadi Nasara, the Valley of Christians, and we have different groups working, implementing programs, especially food, medicine, scholarity, and rent apartments. We don't have a big program. Really, it's limited. For instance, we do something for 700 families in Homs to support them with elementary food. We do a program in Aleppo for 200 families for food, 200 families for scholarity, 200 families to medical care, 100 families for old people. This is our way of working. For instance, we had in March an explosion of a car in a Christian area, a lot of apartments damaged. So we decided to do a program for 50 families to support them. And Kirche Innot helped us carefully and rapidly to do this program. Like this, we are working. Or our programs in all Syria on 1 year, it's around $1 million dollars. Not more, but I think for the future we need more organization, more help to support all those families.
Now, I know Caritas has also been very active with the refugees who have come over from Iraq. What is the situation with the Iraqi refugees? We've also seen in recent weeks many Syrians going over the border into Iraq, which seems ironic.
Yes, many Syrian going to Iraq? I don't think so, no. They are not resettled. Perhaps they go to Lebanon, they go to Jordan, to Turkey, but I don't think for Iraq generally.
The last wire service that I saw said something about 5,000 Syrian refugees arriving in northern Iraq.
Possible, because it's a safe region. Possible. Generally, the situation of Iraqi in Iraq, the number decreases a lot because I worked a lot with the Iraqis, especially with the Chaldeans and the Christians, and even with the Muslim in those last years.
Are they still there in camps? Are they still in apartments rented? No.
Apartment in Damascus. In Aleppo, but the number decreases a lot. We have only staying now in Syria around 20% of those who came in 2003. So the number is smaller.
Did some go home or did they go to emigrate?
Canada, United States, Australia, Europe, and some families in the north of Iraq, those who are not able to have a visa to emigrate. But we are continuing program with the Iraqis too, but now we put all our possibilities to support the Syrian improved in this war today.
One of the things that struck me, looking at some of the photographs of Homs and other towns in Syria, is the fact that you see a church next to a mosque. People have lived pretty much in harmony over these past decades. What is the situation now? People are beginning to talk about perhaps a civil war in Syria. What is the situation?
Yes, really, it's in Syria a big tradition of living together, of respect. There is a big respect towards Christians. Even in this situation, everyone is looking to the Christians, a respectful people, because they don't have any interest in power or domination. So I think we have to say it. There is this tradition of mutual respect, and we hope that we will be able to continue in this way. But when we speak about civil war, it's not between Christians and the others, because Christians generally they don't have any militia or armed people. We are citizens of our country. So the problem of civil war, it will be possible between a majority who is seeking to have the domination on the country and a minority who is now in the government. So this is the problem. But in the case of civil war, the danger is that to use Christians as human shields and so, because they are without any self-defense. This is the risk.
And what is the situation now in Aleppo? It has remained fairly quiet, although you have seen episodes of violence explode there as well.
Directly, no. Since the beginning, we don't have any direct violence. But what we have, I can tell you, first, every Friday, we fear the end of the prayers when the people leave the mosque. Everybody is asking what it will happen. Generally, this is the first thing. The second one, we had in the last month problems in the university with the students, young people who are doing demonstrations against the regime. This existed those last months. The third thing is outside the city, in the country, some opposition, some armed people, some fighting between army, between police and those people in different villages at 20, 30 kilometers. The fourth phenomenon is new. It's the kidnapping of some rich Christians to ask money and to do treatments and so. And it's a very, very bad aspect. We are seeing the same signs like in Iraq in the last years.
The violence in Syria, how can it be stopped today?
I think the call of the church is to dialogue, to refute the violence, dialogue, to reforms. We need political reforms. Syria was under a military regime since 50 years. So with the phenomenon of globalization and pluralism, we need this possibility of discussion, of dialogue, and not to be led by confessionalism, by fanatism. It's not a good way for the future.
Chaldean Bishop Antoine Odo of Aleppo, Syria. Reactions to the UN-sponsored conference on sustainable development, Rio Plus 20, in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, last week have been mixed. Dr. Alison Doig, Senior Advisor on Sustainable Development for the UK-based advocacy organization Christian Aid, is critical about what she thinks the conference accomplished, saying it was stunning only in its lack of urgency. She spoke with me upon her return from Rio.
I think we have coming out of Rio, a very pedantic document that details processes and some of the issues that we want to address. What we don't have coming out of Rio is an inspiring text. There's no inspiration coming out that to lead the world towards solving our massive poverty issues and our environmental degradation issues. I think in the document, all the detail of the document, it doesn't add up. It doesn't equate to the scale of the problems and the challenges we face, and it certainly doesn't inspire a generation. So we have some of the detail they went in to get, but we certainly don't have the inspiration to, you know, for our young people even moving forward to say we're going to deal with this problem.
Well, you know, we talked before you left for Rio, and you were telling me that Christian Aid was going to be pushing for greater social justice for the world's poor and underprivileged. You were going to be calling for sustainable agriculture, water, sustainable energy. Which area of these would you say suffered the most in the document, the concluding document of this conference?
I think the social justice element was failed on. I think there was a distinct, whereas a lot of the issues were identified as problems, there were a few, there was a complete lack of targets and goals and commitments within that. And there were a number of countries, mostly the very rich developed countries, such as the US, the EU bloc, Canada, Japan, who were determined to get the language of responsibility out of the text. So the common but differentiated responsibility, which means each country takes its due amount of responsibility to respond. So the lack of targets and the lack of the responsibility of the wealthy countries who have caused much of the problem to react. So I think the social justice element has been strongly missed out. If you read the text, you do see concern over food, concern over water, concern over energy, but this lack of action and responsibility was definitely missing from that text.
You were speaking there about some of the wealthier countries looking to be less responsible in this final document, but how would you rate, therefore, the participation of emerging economies such as India, Brazil, and China? To what extent do you see them committed to investing in sustainable development?
Well, if you start with Brazil, obviously they set up the conference. They were the leaders in terms of the negotiation, and they were determined to get a text that all countries would agree to. They were very, very determined not to do what happened in Copenhagen a few years ago at the climate negotiations, when the very few elite countries came together and produced a very, very weak outcome that wasn't agreed by all developing countries. So they did play a role in terms of the negotiating process to get a text that all countries may have not been enthusiastic about, but were at least willing to sign up. But overall, the middle-income countries sat in the negotiations very firmly with the G77, that's a group of developing countries. They didn't stand out particularly on any of the issues. They very much held that block together. And what was happening was really, I think you can't look at their role without looking at the role of countries such as the US and the EU. So while there was a push from the richer countries to move towards new sustainable development goals and greater objectives on green economy, the developing country bloc as a group were saying, we don't want to take on new goals. We can't. If we take on those goals, we haven't got the finances, we haven't got the technology to achieve them. And there's no commitments within this text to finance and technology being exchanged. So there was this standoff, really, between the need for goals and the move towards goals, and the developing countries been resistant to take on new goals without the finance and technology. And as I say, the India and China were very much within that mix in the developing country bloc. They are still developing countries, but they are increasingly impacting on the environment. So I know that the rich countries want to pull them out of that bloc and make them stand on their own. But in terms of the renegotiations, it was definitely a standoff between the identified developing countries and the wealthy countries.
Well, what do you think it's going to take then to bring these emerging economies on board? You're talking about the exchange of finances and technologies.
I think for a country like India, that is absolutely critical. India still has massive poverty. Almost two-thirds, three-quarters of their people live in desperate poverty. So there is an emerging wealthy and middle class within India, but there's also desperate poverty, and they still aren't in a position to go to low. And I think China probably stands out as the one country that can and is doing action on environment on its own. It's probably not doing enough as yet. It's in a competitive global market, and it doesn't see Europe, USA, Japan taking the actions that, you know, for environment. So China itself is looking to secure its own resources globally, not just within its own borders, but globally in terms of natural resources. But China, in many ways, particularly on aiming for low carbon energy, for example, it's already made commitments that go beyond what the USA is willing to do. So, but I think China is taking small but significant steps in the right direction on its own. But other emerging economies are still battling poverty within their own borders, and maybe should be redirecting more resources internally. But certainly, to make the step change in terms of sustainable development, will need external assistance ongoing.
Now, I know you and Christian Aid were pleased by contributions made by your own government there in the UK. The UK has pushed through mandatory reporting of CO2 emissions for UK companies. What will that mean in concrete terms? And would you like to see other countries follow suit?
Yes, this is, in fact, a big success for Christian Aid. Christian Aid has been calling for the UK government to hold its own companies to account for its carbon emissions for about 6 years now. So it's been an ongoing, long-term campaign for us. So we were very, very pleased to see this move. So it means that UK companies have to report on their carbon, the larger UK companies have to report on their carbon emissions every year as part of their accounting, presenting their accounts, their financial statement. They have to have an environmental climate statement each year, which means that we can see exactly which companies are moving forward and making progress towards a more sustainable future. And it will also hold not just the good guys, the good companies to account, but also the ones who are more reluctant to make change. It's only looking at the carbon emissions within the UK borders. We know that UK investments around the world, if you count up, UK probably is accountable for about 2% of global carbon emissions. But if you look at UK investment outwards, it's responsible for about 15% of global carbon emissions, our investment through the city. So we want to push it further so that the City of London is responsible for its investments beyond the UK borders. And within the RIIO text itself, there is a movement towards corporate sustainability reporting, having high standards globally for not just climate, but all the environmental and social impacts of companies. And that is something we will certainly be pursuing to push forward. So we've had a step forward in the UK. It's definitely something we want to pursue into the future.
So you see it too as a model that other countries could follow?
Yes, I think the important thing really is to get standardised reporting globally. Developing countries are concerned that this sort of reporting just could become a burden or a trade barrier for them actually, you know, selling into Europe or USA, you know, if they're not reporting any standards. So whereas if we have a global standard for reporting, it means that for each country they're trying to sell into, they will have the same reporting requirements, not multiple, one for each country, which is something they're very, very concerned about. So the more global we can make it, the more standardised we can make it, the more transparent and open I think companies will be. And the civil society, the people from around, particularly the developing world, are very, very concerned about the responsibility of corporates. Corporates were very evident in Rio, and they're very, very concerned that a lot of these corporates, whereas they have a surface of green approaches, actually are not being as responsible as they should do for their impact globally. So I think there is a lot of concern about corporate transparency on sustainability moving forward.
Alison Doig is Senior Advisor on Sustainable Development for Christian Aid.
If you're listening to this broadcast on medium or shortwave in Europe or America, then this announcement is for you. As of July 1st, our programs will no longer be broadcast in these areas and on these frequencies, but they will still be available via satellite, on the internet, on demand and in podcast, and on local radio stations that rebroadcast them. For details, visit our website at vaticanradio.va.
And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. Laudator Jesus Christus.